I didn't ask for the copy it mentioned, but I'll actually allude to that in my presentation. Like she said, I'm Chris Berger. Happy to be here. This is a fun one for me because I'm not really talking about the product first up or anything like that. I'm obviously very passionate about it myself. I brought it to Atrium Health about 4 years ago. But for this one, when they asked, hey, what would you like to speak about? I started thinking about, you know, my career, and you know, once you get to like 25 years and things, you're like, man, you start looking back on everything and it's a little weird. I'm at that age where I now have like that, you know, that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that pill pack where like you're like opening it up on the AM or the PM and you're taking those little pills so you don't forget if you've taken it or not. I'm at that age now. It's kind of weird. I'm looking at the picture and it's like, that definitely was before COVID because I don't have much gray hair. I have a lot of gray hair now. I started thinking about what could I share that would be interesting, a little bit fun. None of this is probably going to be mind-blowing, but I think a little of experience, my experience over the years is just kind of what I have learned along the way, and a little bit of how to think like a CEO. Lucky to have a couple of my teammates here with me, Jolie and Deborah. They are on my internal communications team, doing an amazing job. And I think they probably heard me talk about many of these things, but we always talk about how to think like an executive because that's a huge part of what we do every single day to advance whatever we're trying to do. So a little bit about Atrium Health. She shared a little bit here. Size and scope, 72,000 plus teammates. You know, we're really spread across the Southeast. One of the things that, you know, we talk about is just all, you know, size is one thing, but what are we doing each day? You know, here we have 43,000 plus patient interactions. The big one is at the bottom. We talk about our for all mission, and our mission is pretty simple. It's health, hope, and healing for all. And one thing that we're really proud of is that we provide, it adds up to, billions of dollars, but every single day it's $6.7 million of free and uncompensated care and other community benefits. So it's something that is really, really big for us, and we're always talk about our for all mission. Here, just so you can see kind of where we are, I always love talking about Atrium Health, and headquartered in Charlotte. So major area, our 40 hospitals, 1,400 locations throughout the Southeast, but let's jump into what I'm here to talk about. So I try to find funny images to go with each one. One of the things that has got me through my career, and my career has been really interesting, because I don't have a communications degree, actually. Anybody want to guess what my degree is? You'll probably never guess it. No. Not you, Jolie. What's that? No. Health and physical education and recreation, and health exercise science. So I had a dual major, was going to be a coach or do like a physical therapy. I got involved in doing a lot of stuff in the Office of Admissions in Oklahoma when I went to school there in Tulsa, and really fell in love with something that I had no idea even existed. Had no idea there were even marketing people or communications people in the world. I'd never crossed paths with them growing up. I don't know if I just lived a very sheltered life with my parents or whatever. Well, I did, actually, but that's a whole different story. But this really led me down this interesting path. I met my wife in college. She was a communications major, and I realized I really loved this field. And it was I managed to cram 4 years of college into six and graduated. I graduated and started my career in doing graphic design and marketing, and that slowly progressed, got involved in IABC, and then PRSA, and one thing led to the next, and my career kind of took off in communications, and I've loved it ever since. But one of the things that I think has got me through was trying to hold fast to this idea of assuming positive intent, even when it's the hardest and you know it's probably not. Is assuming positive intent in other people's behaviors, because it'll get you through so many interactions if you start with that they come from a positive place in trying to do whatever they're trying to do. And that's likely the case a lot of times. Now, we can talk about behaviors and actions and all those type of things, but if you assume positive intent, I think it really can help your own mental health and your own well-being more than probably anything else. Because all you can do is control your own behavior, but, and this is especially true when you're dealing with like CEOs and executives and things like that, assume that they're coming from a very positive place, even when they come with some very, you know, kind of interesting feedback. So that's the first one. This is a principle that I have shared with teams over my entire career. One of my biggest kind of career changes was I used to work for Walmart Corporate in Bentonville, Arkansas, and led communications there for their IT, started in their IT shop. It was super weird. Walked into this building, and there's 12,000 people in this building leading their, you know, IT areas, and that's where everything funneled into for everything when you go to a Walmart. And they have like 6,000 stores across the U.S., you know, many more outside the U.S., all of that type of stuff. So trying to communicate that, and then obviously a lot of, I think altogether they have 2.3 million associates across the world, a lot, right? So it was a lot of, and then talking to IT folks, it's not exactly like talking to retail folks, like talking to anybody else. It's a completely different world. So there were a lot of opportunities to get frustrated. And so what I always, one of the things I talked to the teams about was this concept of stop, drop, and roll. Stop, when something comes in your email box, that you want to fire back an email and be like, I'll tell you what, here's my thoughts on this. It's probably not the best idea, right? And so I said, this idea, just keep it in the back of your mind, stop, drop, and roll. Stop, let it drop, and let it roll off your back. And if it's important enough, the next day, come back to it with a more logical response, more thought-out response, because you've probably thought about it overnight, and respond then. But a lot of times, what you'll find is, it's not that big a deal after, you know, you've slept. And that's an important thing, sleep. It's not on the slides, but yeah, sleep is an important thing. But yeah, so stop, drop, and roll has been a really important thing for me, personally, because I'm a pretty passionate person. I can be passionate about a lot of things, but like when I get fired up about something, I have to remember this myself of like, it's not worth, you know, it, you know, some people talk about what hill, choose the hill to die on, you know. Is it worth that hill? Not sure if you want to make that a career limiting, you know, kind of decision of firing back an email to an executive or somebody else, you know, maybe it is. And you have to figure that out, but probably in the moment, it's not. I don't know many emails that you reply back in like high anxiety or whatever that is probably a good idea. Again, some of these things are not rocket science. They're just probably good affirmation of things you already know. So this is one I explain to my team all the time because this is something that I think really helps as communicators. Our job is to provide context for things, right? The idea of starting with why is really important. And context is everything. So when we wonder why managers aren't communicating, people managers aren't talking to their people, right? That engagement survey comes in and it says, you know, we're not communicating. And we all know they're not talking about big C communications, right? They're talking little C. Their managers are not talking to their people. Why aren't they? It's because they probably don't have the context to do that. And what happens is, and I explain it like this. When you're an individual contributor, you have an umbrella that's like this, you know, small, and that's what you're in charge. Anything underneath that umbrella, you're in charge of. When you're a people manager, you have a little bit of a bigger umbrella, and you have all these people around you, and those little umbrellas are the people underneath you. But like the higher you get, that umbrella gets really big. And the reason I say this is really important is because a lot of times we get no for various reasons on things that we're proposing, and we don't understand why. We don't have the context maybe that the president CEO or that high-level leader, that executive has, and they're saying no probably for a very good reason. But we don't have the context for that because we don't have that higher-level umbrella understanding of what everything is under there. And there have been many times when I've almost wanted to fight on that hill and die on that hill, only to find out 3 months later The reason that they said no was there was this massive decision coming 2 or 3 months later that was game-changing. Atrium Health has gone through several combinations, and we call them strategic combinations. Most people would call them mergers. They're not officially mergers because legal says, you know, they're member substitution. Nobody knows what that means. So we come up with these fancy terms that nobody understands either, like strategic combinations. But we've done this several times. There have been several times I wanted to enact something. I was like, nope, now's not the right time. And then come to find out, like, a couple months later, the reason why is we had Georgia, two systems in Georgia joined us, and then we had a larger one, Wake Forest Baptist Health, in Winston-Salem, in North Carolina, joined us. So it's those type of things that I didn't have purview to. But if I would have died on that hill, like, that would have really been really bad for me in my career. And I just have to trust, again, going back to assuming positive intent, that maybe that higher level leader that I'm trying to pitch something to has that better understanding of the world. And the umbrella principle is something that I talk about all the time. There's people that have more understanding of things that are going on than you. Trust that they know what they're doing when they're saying no. You can ask probing questions, things like that, but at some point you just have to understand that. All right. This one's funny. I was reviewing this yesterday, the slides with Jolie, and I said, make it simple even for the CEO. And she says, especially for the CEO. And that's exactly right. It's so I'm real big into providing information every single month. Metrics rule the day for me. Like, when we put in First Up, I wanted to prove that it was working. When we do any type of whatever, I wanted to prove that my team is delivering on what I say they should be delivering on. And so I give a one pager, the team works on it together, of metrics every single month that show my team is delivering. And I'm in charge of internal, external, social media, all of those type of things. So I get a pretty good view of the world of everything. And metrics obviously rule the day for me. So if I'm the CEO, I don't have time to dig into 10,000 pages of everything. I have a very simple infographic style, you know, score sheet that basically says, here's what this month looks like. We're up this area, we're down this area. If it was down, a small little explanation. And it's very, again, very, very simple. Simple for him to look at and say, and if he has questions, guess what? I have the backup information for him. But generally, he doesn't ask because he sees the information he wants to. And he moves on, and he knows what we're doing well and what areas I'm improving or want to improve in. A corollary to this is every single time that we have anything in my department, I'm real big on communication plans, strategic communication plans, and sometimes they're 50 pages. Sometimes they're, if they're a combination, 150 pages, because they have all the details because, you know, I always laugh about this, is what makes up a strategic communication plan? 1,001 tactics, right? That are organized well and put together. And so if you do this, the president CEO very rarely wants to go through 150 pages. What does he want to know? Peace of mind and sleep at night that there is a plan that's 150 pages long. Now, if he says, hey, what's the plan on this? And you're like, well, here's what my team are thinking about doing, da 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 da. Instead, what I have every single time, and almost every single time that there's something has come up, we had one come up last week where, you know, flu is going rampant, right? This year is crazy. If you haven't gotten your flu shot, get your flu shot. If you believe in that. I'm just kidding. So there was a big thing on, like, what are we doing with the flu to share that people need to get their flu shot? Well, almost immediately, I sent a note to my team because there was this idea that we weren't doing stuff. And the funny thing was, it came from my daily media report, right? I get a good and bad and the ugly. It goes to executives or whatever. Well, they saw the news that was in the clips, and I'm like, how do you think that got in the news? Maybe because my team pitched it? That's why it's out there? But here's the other stuff I'm glad to supply you with. And it was like literally like 50 things that had been out there in the ecosphere, you know what I mean? And it showed every single thing that we were doing to make sure that we stayed out in front in our earned and owned media, right? Like, and it's just like, okay, that's great. But so back to this is like, provide, keep it simple and don't belabor the point. Like, CEOs have a sliver of time to focus on anything. I know from my experience, rising through the ranks and now being a vice president of a pretty large system, is like, my sliver of time is pretty small. My umbrella, right? I can't even imagine what the CEO in his sliver of time and his mental shelf space that he has, what that looks like. But my point in that saying all that is like, they have a little bit of energy and time to focus on your small area. Don't waste it with belaboring the point on a bunch of stuff that they don't care about. Give them what they want, and typically it's, you know, infographic style, you know, if you want to think about it that way, information. All right. This one's kind of a funny one. Obviously it says, sometimes you're wrong even when you're right. We all know those situations when we are right. We are absolutely right, and things need to be put in there, but we go about it the wrong way in trying to get it sort of implemented or everything put into place. And I say, like, think about, you know, the whole saying is your attitude determines your altitude. You know, I promise you from an executive standpoint now, I wish someone had sat down with me earlier in my career and talked to me a little bit more about, you know, when I was, you know, right on something, that I just needed to understand the ramifications of what I was, how I was coming across to people. And thinking about, you know, being careful about how that impacted their view of my personal brand and what that would have later on down the road as far as like my career progression. There have been examples of team members, you know, that would just, they would just have really bad attitudes about something that, you know, that they thought they were right on. And then even when confronted with sort of like their, like a higher level view about something, it turned into kind of like this really bizarre, it showed me that they weren't coachable. It showed me that they were not willing to listen to other, you know, ideas out there. And that's a really, really big deal. From an executive standpoint, I can promise you that's one of the things I look for the most is coachability, like at all levels. Like, if you're not going to listen, if I'm going to spend my time now as a vice president, not that I'm like, oh, I'm a vice president now, but if I'm going to spend my time as a vice president to come and have a chat with you about something, it probably means you should listen about, you know, and pay attention, not just shove it off as you're the crazy guy and, you know, whatever else. So, yeah, I think that makes sense. This one correlates to the last one. Fess up when you mess up, you know. As a leader, what I want to see is when there's a misstep, I don't really care about that misstep. Here's what I care about. You recognize it, and you've made a plan for how this will hopefully never happen again. That's all I care about. I don't care about the mess up that happened. There have been several things that I have done throughout my career that have just been, you know, really big messes. But what I do, and there have been times even in this job where as a executive, president and CEO will call me, pretty upset. We have a great relationship. Sometimes that means he feels the freedom to lay into me a little bit more than, you know, others maybe. And so he'll lay into me, and there have been several opportunities, unfortunately, where after he's done, you know, what's my response? I will learn from this. Here's the things I'm going to make sure why this will not happen again, hopefully, and I'll get better. And I've gotten back like this stunned silence, and then like, Chris, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. And for me, that's exactly what I want to hear. I want to know the person on the other end has understood kind of the pain and suffering a little bit of what it has caused, you know, and here's the steps that they want to put in place to make sure those things never happen again. Too many times, what I get is a digging in of their opinion and the reasons why they did everything. And I never hear that here's what I'm going to do to make sure that this doesn't happen again. That does not reassure me as an executive in any way, shape, or form that my team is learning from the mistake and that continuous improvement model is getting better. Does that make sense? So this is probably one of the bigger slides I really want everybody to like think about and sink in a little bit. It's like, again, like, and this goes back to that sometimes when you're right, you're wrong even though you're right, is like, there have been times when I still believe that the decision was right, maybe a response to the media that he didn't like, but it's not understanding like the full picture of how the media works and all that type of stuff. The headline wasn't right, you know, we all deal with those things. They don't care. What they want to know is like that you listen to their opinion, that you heard what their concern was, and you're going to move on and figure out a way to make it better in the future. Bottom line. So this is a really big one for me because I think this will honestly help you rise through ranks if done right, but it will stop you. There have been people on teams that I've led, we've had that discussion where it's like they will not move any past this role until they can understand this idea that there has to be some acknowledgement and has to be a figure out of a path forward. This is probably the biggest like people leadership thing that I've seen stop people dead in their tracks when they are amazing individual contributors. Really, really good. But not willing to acknowledge that there could possibly be something that they need to work on and put in place. Does that make sense? All right. This one's pretty simple, but I see it in executive meetings all the time. The first time a sort of like individual contributor has a chance to talk to our president and CEO in a meeting, and they go crazy on the call where they just want to talk and explain their viewpoint and share their expertise and they're not listening to what is being said, and they just want to, and you can tell when either the president, CEO, or another executive is trying to get a word in edgewise, they're not even listening to what they're saying. What they're thinking about is their response. I tend to, personally, and it's something I've sort of had to work on in my career, actually being too silent in meetings, because I really like to listen. That's one of my like things of like, what is it they call it, the strength finders, you know, where you listen and you process it, and I like to do that. Like, I have to learn to assert myself a little bit more in meetings so people know I'm there and have a voice, and I do have, you know, a thought and a point of view. But I think that this one's really important, I think, because I've seen so many times people thinking about their response without actually listening to the conversation that's happening. And that can also be a career killer, because I've gotten off those calls and I've gotten that call from the CEO afterwards says, I never want to have that person in the meeting again. And that's awkward for me, right? To have to go tell that person who thinks they just killed it because they just explained, you know, how the watch was made when the present CEO said, what time is it? You know, it's just one of those things that listening and then speaking is really, really important. And there's a balance, right? There is a balance there, but that's one of the ones. This goes back to, it's that fight another day, learning like what hill to fight on, but this is a step further. As a executive, what I want to see is when you get knocked down, because you're going to get knocked down, right? We all do. How do you respond to that? Like, how do you respond to change? How do you respond to, you know, we've all had it happen when you're doing really well in your career, and then your manager decides to take another job somewhere else. Your direct supervisor, or whatever level they are, decides to take a job, and you know what that is going to do to your career, right? It's going to put it on hold a little bit. Maybe you were about to get a promotion. You had promised promotion, you had whatever, and you get a new supervisor. Everything's put on hold, right? Because a new supervisor comes in, they have to evaluate you, they have to say if you're ready for a promotion, all that kind of stuff. Whatever the situation is, what I want to see as an executive is when you get knocked down, how are you going to take that? Are you going to like tear the team? Are you going to go into like grumble mode and just like, you know, and how are you going to respond to that? The ones that I see that are around and really they take it with a challenge, everybody goes through the change curve, right? Everybody's in that, what I call the valley of despair for a while before coming out of it. How fast can you come out of the valley of despair? That's what I'm looking for. I acknowledge like the change curve is scientific for a reason. That's human behavior, right? When the announcement's made, it goes into it. How long are you gonna stay in this little valley of despair before like accepting it and coming out of it? And that's what I'm looking for. I acknowledge everybody. I go through a change curve. I had in this role, I report to the chief marketing officer. He hired a deputy chief marketing officer that I now report to. That took me a while to like kind of like get like my head wrapped around. Like, wait a minute. And by the way, both have never ever done communications. And they gave the new guy a chief marketing and communications officer title. And I'm like, say what? You've never done communications. Now I could have like just bitched and moaned all day long about that and probably had good reason to, right? I knew it wasn't ever gonna do me any good. And yes, I was in that valley of despair and I had to figure out a way to get out of that like quickly in order for my own sanity, for my team's sanity, like for them to, because it goes through, right? Like if I feel like that, everybody else around you feels like that. And you know the team members on your team that, you know, are the ones that, you know, rile things up and, you know, anytime there's change. At Walmart, we used to have we used to measure everybody on their adaptability. Like every eval cycle, we would talk about their adaptability or their change quotient, because change is constant, right? It's the only thing that's constant. And so we knew change was gonna happen all the time. Like, how quick can you react to change and the ambiguity around you? That's what this is talking about, is like, I know who on my team is really good with change, and who on my team do we have to do that extra love every single time we do something and have a little extra sessions with them in order to. Those extra people are probably not getting promoted at the same level as everybody else. I'm just saying, right? So just, that's, do you have the grit to basically come back after you get knocked down? This is just another way of saying, don't burn the bridge. I cannot tell you over 25 years how many people reach out to me still asking for recommendations and things like that, that I'm like, why are you contacting me? You were the person that like really stabbed me in the back before. Like, so I think it's really important as you think about your career and you move from place to place. And I've been, you know, I've lived all over the place with my career. I've been in lots of different industries. And one of the things that I think is really important is not leave the bridge intact. And the extra part of that is, if you want their recommendation in the future, stay in touch with them. Do not let it, like the people that reach out to me sometimes for recommendations, I haven't heard from them in like 10, 15 years. Like a lot happens. I know a lot happened to me in 10, 15 years. Like how could I really put my weight behind somebody and recommending for a job when I don't even know who they are as a person anymore? So I purposely go through my LinkedIn contacts every single year, several times, and those managers that have led me in the past or whatever, I catch up with them. There's people in Germany now leading teams. There's people in Israel. There's people still at Walmart, you know, will be for the rest of their lives, that will, like, that I make sure that I'm still in touch with them, because if something happens, it's somewhat selfish, right? But you don't want to be that person that's reaching out to someone later on and just like for the first time. So just think about that too, because I know it stings sometimes. It's like that reach out when someone's trying to hit you up for multi-level marketing crap. You know what I'm saying? You haven't heard from these people in forever. And they're like, hey, can we catch up for lunch? You go to lunch and they're like, so, how do you like Amway? It's not called Amway anymore. It's called something else. You know what I'm talking about. You feel burned, right? You feel like, what are you doing? You're using me. So just leave the bridge intact. And this is the last one, dependability. I really, really like to talk about dependability because it's the thing I want to be known for, is being dependable more than anything else. I used to tell my team a lot of stories. I've kind of cut back on the stories because I think I got feedback that it was too many stories. It's a lot of stories. I love stories, and probably why I love communications. But I was told stories growing up, and they impacted my life. And there's one story that impacted my life, and I'll tell you guys the story, because it really did. At a young age, my mom read it to me in a storybook, and I remember it. And I have the storybook at home because my mom sent it to me after I told her that it really meant, like, it impacted me. So the story goes, there's a young man who's looking for extra help in Iowa. It's farm, think back farms way back, you know, when they really had a lot of farms. They still do, actually, in Iowa. My mom's from Iowa, so that's, I think, probably one of the reasons that it impacted me. But anyways, he was looking for some summer work. Went to the local feed store where everybody, you know, gets hired, those type of things. And, you know, the farmer comes up and he's looking at everybody, and he's not the biggest guy, he's not the strongest looking guy, but he looks like he could do and help out at the farm. And the farmer asks him, you know, can you work the stable, can you work with horses? And his answer is, I can sleep on windy nights. And the farmer's like, oh, that's kind of weird. So he moves on to the next guy. But something draws him back to this guy. And he asks him some more questions about what he can do around the farm. And he said, I can sleep on windy nights. And he, for whatever reason, hires the guy. Guy goes, and he's a great hand. He helps out around the farm, does everything that he needs to do. And as, you know, common in, you know, Midwest, big storms. Like I said, lived in Oklahoma where tornadoes came flying through, but that's the same thing in Iowa. Big storms come through. Huge storm came through at night. And he goes to wake up his farm hand, and he cannot wake him up worth his life. He is dead asleep. And he's shaking him, and he's like, I'm firing this guy in the morning. He's done. So he's like, I guess I'll have to go do everything myself. He goes outside, goes, and wind's blowing, and everything's going nuts, and the hay is completely tarped down. And he goes to the stable, and everything's perfectly closed. You know, the horses are inside. Everything is you know. And he, as he walks around, he's remembering in his mind what he said, I can sleep on windy nights. And his whole thing there was that kid was so dependable, right? He anticipated whatever was going to happen. Didn't know a storm was going to come up that night, but he just did his job right. And he was dependable, and when a storm came, he could sleep through the night. How many times have we put stuff off, you know, and it's like, I'll get to that tomorrow, or whatever. How many times have we done stuff that will if we do it, and do it well, we can sleep at night. And we can put those things out of our minds, and that, I said I was talking to talk about sleep. Sleep is important, as we all know. And that is one of those things that when you have a clear mind, you sleep better. And so dependability is what I'm looking for with my teams that I'm building. I want to know that, again, going back to that communication plan, I want to know that when an executive reach out and says, hey, what are you doing for this? What are you doing for this? I can be like, hey, Jolie, can you get the communication plan? And it's not at that moment that they start building the communication plan, right? It's been put together, and that's what I'm looking for from a dependability standpoint. I'm looking for people on my team that are proactively looking and thinking like an executive, to know when I'm going to ask for things that it's ready to go, that it's not a mad scramble, and it's not a, you know, fire drill every single time something happens. So dependability for me builds trust. And as we all know, trust is the foundation of any relationship. And work is a relationship. You spend more time there than you do anywhere else, pretty much, right? And so just think about like what that builds. Dependability builds trust, and that will advance your career. When someone knows they are the go-to person, and I can count on them when I give them the task to do something, that they're going to get it done, it says everything. So this last slide, I just put a, this was actually from Walmart. There was a leader there that used to share a lot of things. This is a lot. Are they sharing slides? Do you know if that works? Some of these are just really like kind of like, okay, I wasn't going to make a whole nother slide or make this, you know, an hour longer. So I'll just walk through these real fast. Again, one of the things I like to do is hire people a lot better than myself. And Jolie's a good example of that. Jolie leads my internal team. She's amazing. Why is she amazing? Because she's passionate about internal communication, and I trust her fully to do that. And so hiring Jolie and bringing her on to lead the internal communications team is one of those ideas. I do the same thing. I hired another person to lead media relations. They're better than me at media relations. I know how to do it. I could do it. But they're better than me. And that's how my team succeeds. So hiring people is an amazing way. And guess what? It got me promoted. And it's continued to get me promoted. Because if my team trusts me, their job should be just to make me look better. My job is to make my deputy chief communications and marketing officer look better. It's hard for them to get by. Ego. Man, this is what I'm talking about. Like, when you're not willing to fess up, ego can be the worst. It will destroy your career. Enough said. This is about context again. When people know what you want, Jolie probably would share that I'm pretty direct. I'm pretty direct just because I feel like when people know what I want, typically, like it says, they'll often give it to me. And we have good discussions. It's not like I'm closed to having a discussion about things, but like I always figure if I don't set expectations out there, nobody will know what I actually want. So we have discussions, and you know, again, this is something that's important to me. Again, that leads into this one, the ability to give honest, constructive feedback. I feel sometimes I'm the first time to lead a manager that is, again, candid or whatever, because I'm like, no one's ever given you this feedback before. I cannot be the first one to ever see this. Like, you have to work on this if you want to advance your career. I think we're too shy nowadays in today's like PC world that we live in to give true feedback. True feedback is a gift. True feedback done, it's respectful, right? Don't get me wrong. It's not like you obliterate a person. You have to learn how to give the feedback, and each personality is different. But you have to let them know what's happening in order for them to advance their career. This is the how and the what, right? We talked about this, you know, I talk about this a lot. It's like there are people, you give them a task, without any bounds, they will lift 100 bodies in their wake to get that task done, right? That's unacceptable in today's world. Like, that used to be how you did things, right? It's the difference between the what and the how. It's like how you do it is so important while accomplishing what you're doing. Even if you feel strongly about something, there's a possibility you could be wrong. I like that because it leaves that sliver in there of you kind of like remembering there could be a possibility of you being wrong in there. And I think that goes back to the ego, admitting that. And then your harshest critics may be your most helpful voices. I mean, that's so true. Like, sometimes the people that give you the harshest, you know, feedback, that will help you grow in your career in many ways. And then integrity. I don't think that needs to necessarily, that's not a rocket science thing, but integrity is absolutely the most important characteristic. I can remember one of my first jobs. It's like one of those embarrassing moments you remember the rest of your career. Not in a good way. I was having an email correspondence, and I had forwarded an email to one of the executives at a credit union that I used to work at. And in the email, I had gone back through one of my emails, and I had changed a few things in the email because I didn't like how it read when I was forwarding it to prove a point. Well, back in the day, remember when email used to change it to blue anytime you changed anything in a forward? She called me to her office. She says, "I noticed a couple words missing or changed." And I was like, "Oh, shit." I had a moment there where I mean, and she said, "Why did you do that?" And I said, "Honestly, because I'm stupid." I was trying to make it sound better than, you know, what I'd originally sent. And, you know, upon reading it, you know, when you read an email, you know, like I say, a day after or whatever, you want to change some things maybe. Now, no doubt in my mind that at that moment, my integrity level dropped in that executive's eyes. They probably were wondering after that, is Chris full of integrity? I was embarrassed, right? I definitely went back to them and apologized and you know, made it as right as I could. But those moments, again, leave lasting impressions when someone knows that you're not being full of integrity for executives that are above you. And if you don't own, fess up when you mess up, all those things, they all kind of correlate together. This kind of flows together. So that's it. That's all I have. So.